He never said he was, actually. Well, these words like that, word enlightened, is, you know, you have to be aware of how you define it or how it affects you, because, you know, from the ordinary ego, the personal tendencies, we see that as an attainment, something to get, and personality, most people tend to see themselves as unenlightened and with defilements, and then enlightenment is where everything, all your defilements go and you're in a state of perpetual light. Or what do we mean by that word? So this is how to investigate, how to reflect on how you interpret your own views and opinions about Dhamma and the words that we use, like the word Nibbana, the ultimate goal, enlightenment, is you can't really define it. You know, it's usually referred to as the reality of non-grasping. But it's these words tend to be put in a context of sankharas, you know, even though that's not what they're supposed to do. But this is, Nibbana is the highest, and the highest is about the nature of conditioned phenomena. There's the highest, the lowest, the best, the worst, and so we tend to see Nibbana as future attainment, the highest, higher than heaven, higher than the highest happiness. And this is a limitation of language, because language itself is about discrimination. You know, it's about the differences between things, and it's about sankharas, about conditioned phenomena all the time. Now the meditation, mindfulness practices, sati sampajanya, sati panya, this is about not using the thinking mind in order to find enlightenment, but to awaken to reality, which is here and now. So when you try to conceive reality here and now, you just get full of doubt and confusion. So that's why the First Noble Truth is about suffering, not about Nibbana. Taking something quite banal and ordinary in life and reflecting on it, changing your attitude towards suffering rather than trying to get rid of it or find happiness. So Lungpa Cha was, you know, he was never pointing at himself. And every time I would, you know, ask him such questions, and he would never say yes or no. But I mean, it was he'd get me to look at why do I want to know about him? And so it was always a direct kind of pointing at what I was actually thinking or feeling and clinging to. So what is enlightenment? And then what is an arahant, you know? And then is an arahant a personality or an attainment? And when you use these words like attaining stream entry and arahantship and that, to me that doesn't make sense. It's not like, it's not about attaining. Attaining in English context always has like becoming something better than what you are. When you notice the the obstructions to enlightenment, towards nibbana, towards arahantship, are all about relinquishing, letting go. And so it's the reality of letting go. An arahant would be then one who's let go of everything, no longer deluded, even in subtle forms, you know, sees always things as they are. And so it's not, you don't attain it, you just let go of sankharas. And that doesn't mean annihilating them, like it's not annihilation or nihilistic approach. It's just relaxing, letting, not believing in your own thoughts and emotional habits and what other people say and the world that, you know, there's cultural conditioning that we get after we're born. We our parents, our society conditions us to think in terms of the cultural background, the religious background, attitudes, ideals that are part of a cultural conditioning process. And we see the world through, like being American, it's easy to judge the world from the American cultural conditioning, which is very idealistic, you know. So the America, United States, is a country that was established on ideals, and so it doesn't see itself as having a continuous history related to like tribalism or feudalism, or even though, you know, the original ones who migrated from Europe were from you know, monarchical systems. And but we Americans, at least in my experience, we don't think of ourselves as that's a part of our cultural background. It just starts in 1776, and that. And so what ideals are, you know, they're perfection. They're the best you can think of. Like the the thinking process, use superlative thoughts and the highest ideals and create a perfect image, a perfect ideal. That's how things should be. Like, we all know how things should be, how society should be, how Australia should be, how one's partners should be, the neighbors should be, and so forth. So we're very much conditioned to know that how they should be. Life should be fair and just and equal and democratic, and we shouldn't kill each other. We should try to understand and help each other, get along with each other, and so forth. I mean, these are what should be in terms of thinking of ideals. But notice that the First Noble Truth is not an ideal. It's not the way things should be. It is the way it is. And so this is where so many of us have suffered through the cultural backgrounds we're from, because as you grow older, as you become, like in adolescence, in teenage period, you become more critical. When I was a child, I just believed what my mother, father told me and the priest said, and I didn't have problems with that. They seemed to be the authorities and know all the answers. And I didn't question it. And then in adolescence, I started questioning. And I could see that things in my parents that were not ideal, and in other people, in the society, in the American system. And then I became indignant, became obsessed with with anger and indignation. You know, we've got to set it right. We've got to get rid of corruption and racial discrimination and all these kind of ideas were right. You know, they're good ideas, but I wasn't aware of the way things really are. So when you're young, you haven't experienced enough to experience life where you think you can resolve the world's problems, or you're going to make a big improve the social system, the government, you know, with your life the kind of conceit and arrogance of youth. And as you get older, you realize you can't do it, or you can move towards like better options and trying to, you know, this isn't just a passive role of watching conditioned phenomena flow by, but you're opening to the way things are rather than always holding on to ideals of how life should be or how you yourself should be, because one becomes very self-critical when you hold yourself up to high standards and high ideals, and then you fail at living up to the highest standard. Or you're very aware of your own flaws or weaknesses or fears, and then you can feel guilty or worthless because you make mistakes or say things you shouldn't and don't live up to the high standards of morality and compassion that you might hold as ideals. So the way things are isn't about how things should be, but it's observing that all conditions are impermanent. This is a reality itself. It's insight into the nature of conditioned phenomena. And that means mindfulness, sati sampachanya, sati panya, is our ability as human individuals to reflect on the way things are, to awaken to the way it is, rather than try to complain about the fact that life isn't what it should be, you aren't what you would like to be, and on and on like that. So in monastic life, you know, you have that's one thing I found very meaningful, living in Thailand, living in a Thai monastery, living with Lung Hwa Cha and the bhikkhus there, was that they weren't that idealistic. You know, it was because of the cultural difference. And they were much more accepting of human weaknesses and life itself, you know. And they weren't so caught up with righteous indignation because the things aren't what they should be. Where my background, I was very kind of idealistic and part of peace movements in the early 60s, and, you know, wanting to dedicate my life towards improvement of society. And then I began to realize that, you know, I was on a peace march one time in Berkeley, carrying a peace sign, and we were protesting the Atomic Energy Commission. They had an office in Berkeley, California, and suddenly I realized, I noticed in the peace movements that I was involved in, I was involved with two of them in that area, was that there's a lot of internal fighting among people that are demanding peace. And then I noticed walking with a peace sign in a poster by the Atomic Energy Commission, and suddenly it dawned on me, I wasn't peaceful. I didn't even know what I was talking about. I thought, this is, you know, I'm a hypocrite because I'm demanding the United States government make peace with the world when I can't even find it in myself. I was in all kinds of conflicts in my mind, in my emotional habits. So that's what, you know, really moved me into monastic life, was an attempt to awaken to life rather than to just demand that life be a certain way and then feel either you become, you know, you just give up in the end, or you become very cynical, or you're constantly blaming others, you know, the people around you or the government or, you know, some whatever is available to blame, or yourself. Where the Buddha is pointing to dukkha or suffering, nobody's to blame for that. It's not, I mean, if somebody, even if somebody is slandering you or persecuting you, it's your aversion and anger and resentment that is the real suffering. How much control do we have over the world around us to make people just say the things that are true and right and helpful and encouraging to us? You know, but we can understand through wisdom the nature of conditioned phenomena. Then our relationship isn't dependent upon success or being understood by others, or we aren't demanding that anymore from the world around us, that our happiness depends on people liking me and approving of me and on like that, which is on a personal level, personality wise. My personality depends, to make me feel good as a person, I need to be approved of. But in terms of Dhamma, in terms of reality, disapproval or approval, praise or blame, success or failure, are conditioned phenomena. And your refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha is refuge in mindfulness and wisdom rather than in personal habits, emotional habits, or your ego, or your identity with your physical body. So, Lungpa, the reason why I refer to Lungpa Cha as enlightened, because I lived with him, or near him, for 10 years, certainly, at first, you know, I didn't know. I didn't have any, except I felt, you know, a liking for him, personal interest in him as a teacher. But in terms of attainment or realization, I didn't know, because I didn't, in just like peace, I didn't know what it was. How could I judge Ajahn Chah, whether he was an arahant or not, from the position of my personal feelings about him? It doesn't make sense. And it'd be arrogant of me to just, you know, make statements about somebody else just from my personal reactions to them. But in terms of relinquishing and letting go, and as I had more insight into the Four Noble Truths during my life with him, I began to you know, really respect him in his relinquishing and his compassion. He's a very compassionate teacher. and very direct, you know. And I never felt I was ever being used or misguided. I mean, I could, you go through the first few years, you go through doubts and suspicions and reactions, especially to people in authority. I mean, he was the authority figure. But basically, I trusted him, which is a feeling, you know, that you can't really define, but you know, you feel he's trustworthy. And then over the years, you know, that became more conscious of that. First, it was based on just my wanting to find a teacher I could trust. And then through my own insight. This is important, it's not an attack on idealism that I'm talking about. It's not, ideals are beautiful. They're like guiding stars high in the sky, you know, they're perfect. but they don't feel anything. They have no, they're like marble statues, or they're perfected, because they come and go and like old sankharas. But you can always hold on to ideals and judge everything by ideals of how things should be, and yourself included. And then you're just going to feel something wrong with you, or something's wrong with the world you're living in. And we become cynical, embittered, disappointed, and despairing. We do that to each other with husbands, wives, children, parents, and so forth, you know, wanting to find somebody you can love forever or trust forever, who'll never let you down or always be there for you. And these are ideals. And then, you know, we spend our life trying to find somebody who fulfills these ideals. We're bound to be disappointed, because these human forms are not ideal forms. They're changing forms. They're not, you know, you can create like a Buddha Rupa. The Buddha Rupa behind me is an ideal form. It's the human form, and the Buddha is fully aware. He's not closing his eyes and refusing to look at life, or plugging up his ears, or hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. He's not afraid or intimidated by sankharas, but he knows. Knowing is this ability of consciousness with wisdom, knowing reality. So like consciousness, that's what we're experiencing now, is consciousness. And then the particular differences, they try to look at consciousness as unitive rather than as personal. So consciousness has no boundary, no limits, no quality other than the ability to know. And so consciousness is not tainted by cultural biases, religious prejudices, or personality, or past actions, or whatever. Consciousness is pure, and we're all experiencing the same consciousness. It's not like mine is separate from you, but there's consciousness that we're all experiencing, and then the differences come up, like our thoughts, our emotions, our physical forms and so forth are what separate us. So we see each other through the eyes. I'm sitting here, you're sitting there, we're two separate bodies, and then what you're thinking right now isn't going to be exactly what I'm thinking or what you remember. On the level of sankharas, they're all differences. But in consciousness, there isn't any difference. And then you apply that to life itself, to the universe, like the animal kingdom, the birds and the insects. And you see, the difference lies in the forms. Like a mosquito has a different form than a human being. It's obvious truth. But I'm not asking you to believe me, but to reflect from this point where the forms, you know, are infinitely variable, the sankharas, you know, and then their karma is from the form they have, you know. So a mosquito has the same consciousness, but the form and the instinct and the karmic tendencies are that of a mosquito rather than something that I can relate to as a human being. As a human being, I don't like mosquitoes. And I used to think, why did God create mosquitoes? If I were God, I would never have created mosquitoes and things like that. But this is a reflection, not a kind of dogmatic position, but reflection means that we're investigating our reality here and now. If we were totally separate consciousnesses all the time, we tend to experience consciousness through senses, through the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. But so in that sense, they are that kind of consciousness through senses is separative. It's not unitive. But with mindfulness, then we're aligning ourselves with the what is often sometimes referred to as unmanifest consciousness. Impersonal, it's anatta, it's not personal, not male or female, it's not even Buddhist. So then from this position of sati sampajanya, then we reflect on the way things are, and then the Buddha said, you know, all conditions are impermanent. So we're not to grasp that just believe it because the Buddha said it's pointing for us to see this for ourselves, to be able to notice conditions. Like the Thai Ajahns usually point to their here, to themselves, not as a personal thing, but to the heart area where we feel life. We're looking at the rising and ceasing of feeling a lot, because our what they call our arome or aramana in Pali, the mood, the mental state that we're experiencing is changing. It has no, there's no permanent emotional state that we can achieve and sustain and keep. They're in this process of changing. So we're awakening to change rather than to the quality of the particular feeling that we have now. Where as a person, you know, you whatever you're feeling now, you could be judging it as good, or you feel interest, you feel doubt, do you feel trust, are you confused? And it's you that know what you're feeling. You know, it's this consciousness knowing that feeling is like this. Consciousness and wisdom. Sati sampajanya panya. it's just very brilliant exposition that Buddha made, just in the simple teaching of the Four Noble Truths, because it works. It's not just theoretical, and it's not. We're not asked to believe in the Four Noble Truths. They're tools to use, investigative tools to use to understand this experience of consciousness within a form, and that's what we're experiencing now. We're experiencing consciousness within the form of the human body. The Buddha Rupa is an iconic form. So the Buddha Rupa, I mean, you can, you know, swear at it and do all kinds of things, and the Buddha Rupa doesn't feel anything. It holds its sati sampajanya perfectly until a bomb lands on it or something, melts it down. But, you know, we're living with feelings, with sensory experiences. We're sensitive forms in a sensitive universe. And sensitivity has no quality that's permanent. The sensitivity is about pleasure and pain, about high and low, right and wrong, and pleasant and unpleasant. And there's no permanent pleasant or unpleasant, but there's knowing that a pleasant feeling is like this if you're experiencing it. And what is it doing? It's changing. You're not indulging, grasping pleasure and trying to sustain it and keep it forever, but you're willing to let go of pleasurable feelings to allow panya or wisdom to inform you of the nature of a phenomenon. And then displeasure, the same thing, whether it's pleasant or painful, pleasurable or unpleasurable. And what is it that knows this? It's not personal anymore. It's anatta. It's not like me as a person knowing impermanence, because the very ego itself is a conditioned phenomena. It's not consciousness. It's a condition, identity with the body I have, with my past, with my memories, with my feelings, with the things I've experienced in life. These are, you know, conditions that you're not born with. They're not permanent. They change. And we identify with memories, with emotional habits, with fear, with greed, with anger, jealousy. And we believe that anger is mine, or fear, jealousy is my problem. And this is thinking again. You have to think to become a person, become a separate person. And I've done a lot of experimentation on this, because like the first fetter, there are 10 fetters that are obstacles to enlightenment, to the seeing. The first three are the obstructions to seeing the path, stream entry. You can't know stream entry as long as these three fetters are your modus operandi, as long as you're operating from these three fetters. And the first three fetters are created by human beings. They're not they're not natural fetters. They're like the human body is a natural phenomenon, and consciousness is natural. But then our identity with the body, this is my body, the language I think, the pronoun I, and then the first fetter is sakyaditti, which is the personality view or the ego. this sense of total commitment and belief that I am this physical form, this person here. And to become a person, I have to think, you know, I have to believe that and think that I am Ajahn Sumedho all the time. That's a, you know, that's a title, that's a name. So, but when you begin to not think, you're no longer seeking to identify yourself or define yourself with words or concepts. When there's sati sampajanya, there's no, you know, Ajahn Sumedho is not present. That comes up under other conditions when somebody addresses me or whatever, then you become that. But the knowing, the discerning ability to discern that the ego is a human-made condition. You're not born with an ego, with a sense of that you are the body, that you are a boy or girl or a Thai or Australian. This information you get later from your mother, from your father, from your society. So the Sakyaditi is an artifice made by human beings. And then to witness this, to know the thinking process, not to despise it or to reject it, but not to be caught in the momentum of thinking habits. Like the ego is very much a thinking habit, and how you see and define yourself. There's so much emphasis now in modern psychology and Western science and Western culture to you must have you must define yourself, you must describe yourself, you must know what you really are as an individual, and there's so much emphasis on individuality and separateness and finding where do you belong in this society, where do you fit into this group or these social norms and political views. People are, you know, fighting wars over views about God and morality and things like that, willing to kill each other about views about morality. So where does this come from? From ignorance, isn't it? It's not understanding things as they are. It's a blind grasping of ideas, of attitudes, of social biases, cultural biases, personal limitations. So then Sakyaditi is the first vara. This is the big obstruction. So if we're practicing meditation with Sakyaditi, you know, then you don't get very far because you just go around in circles, you know, because you're seeing yourself in terms of someone who's got to get something you don't have by getting rid of things that you have that you shouldn't have or you don't want, obstructions. But we're not, in this reflection on Sakyaditi, we're not trying to destroy the ego, annihilate it. It's not that you ever get rid of your ego and you become just a bland, equanimous blank through mindfulness. It's just that you see through the ego. You know it in terms of the way it is, as anicca, dukkha, anatta, as impermanent and unsatisfactory in itself. The ego is never going to be a satisfying condition to grasp. And anatta, we're not limited, bound into the forms that we create in our minds, in our identity with our bodies. Then the second fetter is Silabhata Paramasa, which is quite a mouthful, actually. It means like cultural conventions, cultural conditioning, social conditioning, like a lot of what we think and feel is biased according to the ethnic messages we get, the religion, the social status we hold in the family or in the society, cultural attitudes that we acquire just through being born and growing up in Australia. We are going to acquire those kind of cultural assumptions, biases, attitudes that are part of Australian cultural conditioning. But these are created by human beings. You're not born as an Australian. Even though you might think that, it's not. You acquire that identity later on. And then the third one, even more interesting, is doubt. And doubt is always the result of grasping thinking, because we're thinking creatures. We think, we have language, we have a retentive memory. We remember the past, and we have a language, to use to create illusions with, to believe in our own thoughts and identities about what should or shouldn't be, or what's right and wrong. And so, thinking itself, the Buddhist path, the Eightfold Path, is sammaditti, sammagamanto. It's the right view, right attitude, not through cultural biases anymore or through personal preferences, but through understanding the noble truths. It's a profound understanding, awakening of a human individual towards seeing in this simple way that all conditions are impermanent. So in the, the Buddhist, before he was enlightened, he spent 6 years in various meditation practices. And according to the scriptures, he would outdo his teachers. He'd go to various gurus at the time, or swamis, and they would teach him various forms of concentration practices, and he could achieve these very easily and readily. But they're also impermanent. And, the Buddha, before when he was the ascetic Gotama, saw this was not the way to enlightenment, to freedom. But and so he left his five colleagues and went to Bodh Gaya and sat under the Bodhi tree. What did he realize in enlightenment? What is it that the Buddha actually understood, that his five colleagues, with all their brilliance and expertise in concentration, didn't understand? And then it sums it up: all conditions are impermanent. Sabbe sankhara anicca. Very simple. But it's not, it's from a profound insight into the nature of phenomena, not a belief, and not an intellectual belief or grasping of an idea. But when he, after his enlightenment, he thought, how can you teach Dhamma? It has no language, it has no form. And who's capable of understanding this ultimate reality? And then the Brahma god, Brahma Sampati, came to him and said, there are those with only a little dust in their eyes. Go forth for the welfare of those. So here we are. Then on the way to, he was, through psychic powers, you know, he could find out where his five colleagues were. They were in Sarnath. So he had to walk from Bodh Gaya to Sarnath near Varanasi. On the way, he met another, an ascetic who was very impressed by his presence, by his aura or whatever, and asked him, what is it that he learned? And he said, I am the perfectly enlightened one. And then the samana didn't believe him. That's not the way to teach Dhamma. It was true. You know, what Buddha wasn't lying, or it wasn't inflated ego or overestimation. But most of us come from the ego. So we just see that as ego, you know, overestimation, inflated ego, or madness. And some people will believe, you know, various experiences in my life where people announce that they're the Messiah or the Maitreya Buddha, and immediately my, you know, I find it very difficult to believe that, but they. But there are those that do, actually. But when he went to Sarnath, he didn't say, I'm the perfectly enlightened one. He said something very unusual. There is suffering, there's the origin, the beginning, it has a cause, there is an end of suffering, there's the way of non-suffering, and the Four Noble Truths. His first sermon was, notice how skillful he put it, that it wasn't saying, I am the perfectly enlightened one, because they probably wouldn't have, that doesn't really help you, to because it's, the pronoun I and these words are seen in terms of grasping views and opinions. But suffering, when there is suffering, there's a way it suddenly awakens you, there is suffering, and it's changing from blaming it on others or on situations or seeking to find happiness all the time, distracting yourself from your fears and anxieties towards sensory distractions or whatever. We can distract ourselves from suffering, but to understand. And this is the what the Buddha advised, there is suffering, it should be understood. To understand is to, you have to really accept it, to hold it, to feel it, to notice it, in order to understand. If you're always just caught in aversion and seeking distraction, then you'll never understand anything. You just run around. Your life will be, you know, running around seeking sensory distractions or whatever to avoid anxiety or fear or worry. But when we start seeing that these emotional forms of dukkha, of suffering, which we're understanding them, means we're willing to feel them, to observe them, because the consciousness is non-personal. So consciousness is knowing, it's discerning sankharas, which is not criticizing them. It's not about thinking about them or judging them, but discerning sankharas are impermanent. And so at the end of the Dhammajakkappavattana Sutta, the first sermon, we chant Anya Kondanyo. The Buddha announces Kondanyo has understood. And what is it that Kondanyo understood was that sape sankhara anicca, all conditions are impermanent. And so this is, and yet that sounds you know, we think of Buddha's enlightenment as he would reach the highest states of concentration practices, and then he realized nirvana. That must have been absolutely fantastic, you know, over the top. And what does he realize as enlightenment is, it's like becoming God or knowing everything about everything. You know, God is an idea that God knows everything about everything, but he didn't become God. He's not a deity. But it was the Buddha, the awakened consciousness within a human individual, is Buddha. So I'll stop here, and hope it encourages you all to practice.